Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our January 26th, 9 a.m. service. The sermon title is Finding Meaning in the Dark, presented by husband and wife team Michael Dowd and Connie Barlow. The music following the sermon is The Prophet Bird from Forest Scenes by Robert Schumann, performed by Akui Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
I have two readings this morning. The first from Wendell Berry. To know the dark. To go in the dark with a light is to know the light. To know the dark, go dark. Go without sight. And find that the dark, too, blooms and sings. And is traveled by dark feet and dark wings. From Joy Harrow, Eagle Poem. To pray you open your whole self to sky, to earth, to sun, to moon, to one whole voice that is you, and to know there is more that you can't see, can't hear, steadily growing and in languages that aren't always sound, but other circles of motion. Like eagle that Sunday morning over Salt River, circled in blue sky, in wind, swept our hearts clean with sacred wings. We see you, see ourselves, and know that we must take the utmost care and kindness in all things. Breathe in. Know we are made of all of this, and breathe, knowing we are truly blessed, because we were born and die soon within a true circle of motion, like eagle rounding out the morning inside us. We pray that it will be done in beauty, in beauty. Finding meaning in the dark. I love that Wendell Berry poem because finding meaning in the dark, I think, begins with loving, cherishing, welcoming the dark and finding the blessing in that rather than what most of us innately or instinctually try to do is move through the dark as quickly as possible to get back to the light because we feel more comfortable in the light. We feel more comfortable in the realm of what we know rather than what we don't know. So Connie and I, it's actually been many, many years since we've co-created a sermon where we really didn't figure it out all ahead of time and we're just sort of trusting our gut and trusting the flow of life. So we'll see how this goes, but I'd like to begin by saying that to find meaning in the dark is not the same thing. Imagine you're in a dark room. Well, there's lots of things that you can do that would be more physical. Finding companionship, finding someone's hand to hold, that sense of safety or comfort. Finding a sense of love where you feel that someone's kindness, generosity there. But finding meaning immediately puts us into the half of our brain that deals more with abstraction and thoughts and understanding. So I want to speak very briefly, and then we'll just talk about lessons we've learned from a project that we've been engaged in for some months now called Post-Doom, Regenerative Conversations Exploring Overshoot, Grief, Grounding, and Gratitude. And we're having conversations, I'm having conversations with literally some of the top people in the world. We just posted my conversation with Barbara Cecil and Joanna Macy just last week. And these conversations are with people who have done the grief work
of coming to accept that things are not perpetually progressing, and that, in fact, a Star Trek vision of the future, you know, from the caves to now to the stars, is a pipe dream. It's not going to happen. And there are many people that still find that problematic, because all of us who grew up in the 20th century, we know that the most difficult time emotionally to be alive is when you're born into expanding times of possibility, more than enough energy, more than enough resources, and then in your lifetime it shifts and you go into overshoot, and you're now in what's called carrying capacity deficit. This is carrying capacity surplus. This is carrying capacity deficit. We know of over 100 city-based civilizations that have gone through this boom and bust cycle. And we know that when you're born into times of expansion and you die in times of expansion, progress isn't a belief, it's a fact. Or at least human progress for some people. And then if you're born in times of contraction, it takes half the time for a civilization or an empire to contract and collapse than it does to become great. We know that if you're born and you die in that, well, all you've ever known is things are becoming harder and harder, more and more challenging, et cetera, et cetera. Material wealth, more and more poor, except that often in emotional and relational health, things get better in contracting times. That's the paradox, because there's a lot of dysfunction on the way up. And so we know that those born in times of expansion and who live to see days and months and weeks and sometimes decades of contraction, that's emotionally the most difficult time. So this is experienced for most of us emotionally as dark or difficult or challenging or problematic or depressing or infuriating or whatever. And so finding meaning in the dark then embraces what we know evidentially, what science has told us about our history, including the rise and fall of unsustainable civilizations and what that's about. I'll talk a whole lot about that tomorrow night. But also, how people live for the first 97% of human history more or less sustainably. That is, more or less in right relationship to primary reality. Treating primary reality as a greater thou, not a lesser it. And all of these people that I'm talking about, and that Connie's doing the video editing in this post-doom conversation series, they get the big picture, they've moved through whatever stages of grief and other emotions are there, and they open up to an entire universe of possibility on the other side of accepting and then ultimately finding the gift in the darkness, finding the blessing in how we can be, not just how we can have hope, far more importantly, how we can be hope for others, including other species.
Finding meaning in the dark. It's good to stay in the dark for a while, but you don't want to be there forever. Like any sort of individual grief we go through, stages of grief, repeating them again and again. But it's wonderful to have an opportunity to see a glimmer that's more than just an intellectual out there, well, maybe there will be blah, 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 but no. How can I participate in there perhaps being a glimmer of light, either at a systemic scale or at the individual scale? A lot of people in terms of compassion and being with one another. I was very fortunate that Michael started this idea of doing the conversations, and I immediately said, I will be the video editor. Any of you who felt the darkness of this time in human history for Earth, if you've already had a chance to Where's Your Joy meet Earth's great needs, where do you have skills and that you can step forward and do it? Wow, does that help? I happen to be a skilled video editor. I wrote science books in the 90s. But you have to be a meticulous writer to be able to get the kind of expression, to convey the expression, the emotion, the tone of voice that you automatically get with orality. And we happen to be in an internet time now where Michael can get on a Zoom call just with their computers with Australia and the UK face to face talking with people. And I get to edit that and post it up on YouTube. And while I'm doing that, I'm feeling I'm part of a community. I'm not alone. I'm feeling not just what they're saying, but many of these people have a presence. It's not just what you say or what you do, but have a presence that I go, wow, you can already have accepted this as the possible future, and yet you can still be like that, talk like that. I want to be like that. They're mentoring me. But when it comes to conveying what I've already learned from these, I've edited the video of 15 now. Michael's got like 50 more. I mean, I won't be walking anymore by the time I finish editing that many. It takes me about 4 or 5 days each one. I put in a lot of pictures and so forth. But while I'm editing these, I'm taking in the concepts, I'm trying to remember them. Like any school person, it's like, oh yeah, yeah, I want to bring this into my life. I want to bring this into my life. But what I walk away with, what I learn, again, it's orality. I remember the stories. So I'm going to give you 3 stories. I don't even have to go back and look at the videos. I remember these stories. And classically, in orality, what happens to stories through time? I can't guarantee that I'm telling them exactly factually. They're what move me. So the first story I'll tell is Joanna Macy. How many of you nod your heads if you, yeah, okay, she's 90 now. And we've known of her for a long time, her active hope, her grief work, her activism, anti-nuclear activism that she was very engaged with in the 80s in particular and into the 90s. And what I learned that made me go, someone as great as Joanna Macy told the story of how she initially got into her activism. It was the 70s. She still had kids at home at that time, and she and her kids, she was in Boston, went to some museum or conference center there that had a whole multi-floor display of from the Jacques Cousteau Society. And back in the 70s, it was all depressing. Jacques Cousteau Society was trying to wake us all up back then about all the things going wrong on this planet because of our actions. And she said in this interview, she said she just had to sit down at one point. And it took her 10 years to process that grief. She had plenty of things to do. She could distract herself. But eventually, she worked through it 10 years later. This is Joanna Macy. Hey, if it took her 10 years, I'm allowed some time, you know? I'm allowed to have that. Another story that I loved from the interview, Richard Heinberg. Richard Heinberg is only 1 year older than I am. Unlike me, though, while he was in college, he read the 1972 Limits to Growth. And you know what he said in his interview? I mean, he's written many books. You would never guess this of him. He said, oh yeah, 1972 when I read that book, my view ever since has been this about the future. Not this. And yet he smiles. He's been in action. He writes books. Wow, I can be that way too. Third one I want to mention. This is one of the younger people that Michael has interviewed. This person's from the UK. Very active early on and continuing in Extinction Rebellion. He just turned 40, and I love his story. The story he told was that he was going, when he went off to college in his second, I mean, he was brilliant, he had all these dreams, I'm going to do this career, wow! Second year in college, his dad sent him an article and said, read this. The future is not what you think it is. and it had something to do with climate change. And the way Sean Chamberlain tells that story, to Michael, looking at the, you know, the camera and the computer, it's like, I just feel this, because his dreams went down. And it gives me, as a boomer, real insight into the differences between the boomers, where we're concerned in the abstract about the future and our grandchildren, but the young ones, it's like, the future you all had, that ain't mine. I can't use my brain. I can't write books and get them published the way you could. It's a real sobering sense. So I'm grateful for this conversation series and that I get to be in action using my video editing skills. It really helps me see light in the darkness.
I want to speak briefly about a pre-doom sense of activism and a post-doom sense of activism and how we engage with each other, because pre-doom activism is still usually in order to, it's with the belief that we can still transform the systems and save industrialism from the consequences of its own actions. So it's often very a sense of urgency, a sense of, you know, almost a passionate desire to get as many people engaged as possible, because we can see the difficulties coming, we can see the things collapsing, and we know that if certain things aren't done, we will never become sustainable. And so pre-doom activism is often fear-based and in order to. Now let me back up before I even describe post-doom activism, because I just realized I haven't defined the terms. Doom is the midpoint between denial and regeneration, with or without us. I mean, Earth will regenerate. Life will regenerate. That's what Earth does. That's what that whole Earth had a challenging childhood little parable that we did with the kids is about. That's what life does. That's what, you know. So doom is the midpoint. Many people think it's the end point, which is why we avoid it, like the plague, because we think we're going to live in despair the rest of our lives if we allow ourselves to accept the fact that every unsustainable civilization at some point isn't sustained. And we're in profoundly in a pattern of contraction and collapse that is now inevitable. We have over 120 examples of how that happens, and we're classically right in the pattern. So we will not, and this is probably going to come as a shock. Some of you, I wouldn't be surprised if you walk out when I'm about to say what I'm about to say, which is that we will never transform the systems by voting the right people into office or in making the changes of consciousness that we need to make locally. I'm not saying we don't need to work hard to do that, because it can make a profound difference in what ultimately emerges out of the collapse. But we're in a decades-long process of contraction, and where things every year and every season aren't quite working the way they did last season or last year. And now that the jet stream is doing this waggy thing, we're living in a situation where it is not outside the realm of possibility that we could see 1 billion or 2 billion or 3 billion people starve to death in the next 10 years. And anybody who doesn't understand that as at least a possibility doesn't get the big picture. I'll be talking a lot about this tomorrow night, but not in a merely scary way, but in a way that allows people to go, oh my gosh, of course, of course, of course. Because when you have our best global collective intelligence, that is our best scientific understanding of our history and our nature, those two things, when you really understand cross-culturally our history and our nature, then you see something happen like the last election and like some of the political and economic insanity of this world. And rather than going, oh no, this shouldn't be, you say, oh, right, right on schedule. Because this is what happens. This is how empires contract and collapse. This is the political insanity. So then your activism comes from a post-doom place. Because post-doom is what opens up on the other side of acceptance. You know, you've got the Kubler-Ross stages of grief. You've got denial, bargaining, anger, depression, acceptance. And then when you accept that our society is mortal, that we are in fact in a decaying, dying process that is inevitable, then on the other side, you open up to spheres of compassionate, generous, fearless action, because you're already at peace with the worst case scenario, which is the worst case scenario is we go extinct in the next 50 years. And it's really difficult even getting there. But the fearlessness of our activism comes from the place that in every previous collapsing, or virtually every previous collapsing civilization and empire that we know of, heroes, sheroes, saints, and sages emerge, and people experience more interdependent love, more engagement with people, because the word compassion itself means suffering with. And when we suffer with others and when we're engaged with others, our communities are tighter, our engagement in each other's lives are more profound, and people who have gone through great depressions and serious wars, some of you I'm sure are old enough, you've had that experience, and know others who have, often report that those are the most meaningful times. So finding meaning in the dark is finding ways to be hope for others, and ways of extending compassion and generosity in the midst of contraction, in the midst of collapse. A collapsing biosphere. See, we think of collapse like this, but it's almost always a stair step with partial recoveries. That's the way biospheres collapse. That's the way that societies and empires collapse. And when you understand that, then you are engaged from a fearless place, because you understand history. You understand our nature, that we're not separate from nature. We're not separate from the universe, that we are life becoming aware of itself. And that sense of identity with time and space is what gives us the fearlessness. It's what motivates action from a non-frenetic place. So it's actually more effective activism, and more effective engagement with where we can make a difference, which is usually locally.
Another thing that I'm gaining while I'm doing the video editing is I'm very curious about one of the big questions, in addition to what's the story, in detail, your personal story of how did you start out as a kid, what did you think the future was going to be, and what was it that started taking you down this route where your worldview gets kicked out from underneath you and you have what's sometimes called the death of expectations? What triggered that for you? How long ago was that? Where are you at right now? How far down the scale are you? And one of the questions towards the end that Michael gets into is, what are the spiritual resources that you use for resting in this spot, wherever it is on this scale of darkness ahead and now? What are the spiritual resources? And so I'll name those three people again: Joanna Macy, Richard Heinberg, and Sean Chamberlain, where I remember their stories. Here's how they responded to those questions. Joanna Macy, as many of you know, is a Buddhist. She's written books in that regard, and Buddhism has a couple principles going with it that are automatically helpful, especially for Western industrial people to be able to grasp during this sense of contraction. And one, of course, is life is suffering. Duh, life is suffering. And the second one, really important for activism, that you do what's right, you act with virtue, not with an expectation or a demand that it's going to result in what you want it to result in. You act without attachment. So beautiful for this time. It's the only way to do action in which you're not worried about, will this make a difference? Will this make it? No, it's the right thing to do. I will do it, and I will do it with you. And I will do it with you. I will find peers, Olympic angels, I will find peers to work with. So that's Joanna Macy. She also mentioned she was brought up, well, Christianity, and she's pulled some resources from Christianity, spiritual, that she's found helpful too. Michael has a whole interview with Richard Rohr, well known for liberal, progressive Christianity. A lot in that interview. Moving to Sean Chamberlain, what I found, he couldn't specify exactly. I think he grew up rather secular, as a lot of people younger than boomers grew up secular. But he draws from Taoism very strongly, but not overtly in there. He will mention it. And I thought, well, that's, yeah, sure, Taoism, that would work. Richard Heinberg's story of where he gets his spiritual sustenance was the most meaningful to me. I met Richard a couple years ago. We had lunch with him. And what struck me about it, well, first of all, two things. But what struck me about it was that his spiritual sustenance goes back to same time, right in and after college. He read the Bhagavad Gita, the story of Arjuna and Krishna. Ah, that's what's kept him going all these decades. Arjuna and Krishna, the story is Arjuna is this leader of these warriors, and Arjuna sees that, oh my gosh, you've got this group over here, this group over here. We're related. What in the heck are we doing fighting each other? And Krishna comes in and says, this is the way things are. You must do your job. You do your work in the world and do not be attached to the results as to how this comes out. And that's what Richard has used. The second thing about his story, and I'll finish with this. All of these people thus far, because we haven't had any talks with an Australian of late, I'm sure if we do, we're going to hear it. But there was only one person who has directly been significantly emergency-wise affected by climate change. Richard Heinberg lives in Santa Rosa, California. And he was one of those who, in the middle of the night, neighbor knocking on the door, quick, get out, get what you can and leave. And he spoke about that. And yet, we had to pull that out of him. He wasn't coming right on and said, let me tell you the story about blah, 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 blah. But no, it's important for us to hear that, to hear the stories going on with the animals and the people in Australia now. I know it's affecting me deeply. So again, in this time, whatever the concepts we have, whatever the spiritual resources, it's the stories that move me, and it's the stories that I remember.
So tomorrow night, it says in the bulletin that I will be doing a multimedia presentation on post-doom inspiration, finding joy in contracting times. It actually won't be a multimedia presentation. It will be more of an engaged dialogue. I will be spending probably about 20 minutes in some detail about what our best science tells us about our history and our nature and the lessons we can learn from that. And then we're going to spend the next hour engaged in where do you find meaning in the dark? Where do you find joy in these challenging, contracting times? And then how can you as a community, and this is part of the one that I'm going to put back to you, because I did this last week or 2 weeks ago. I spoke at a large church in Hood River, and I didn't use slides, and I engaged it like I'm going to be doing tomorrow night. And it was probably the most meaningful and moving experience, an evening program that I've ever done. Partly because I wasn't using slides and I was engaged, but there were twice where a number of us were moved to tears. And so I want to hear from you how you imagine, as a congregation, being fully prepared, or as prepared as you can be, to be a blessing to your community, in addition to the ways you already are, because we are in the early stages of the greatest mental health crisis in human history. As more and more of your friends and neighbors and family members realize that perpetual progress is a secular religion that's not true, and as more and more of your friends and neighbors realize
that voting the right person in office in Washington isn't going to make the difference that we are hoping that it will make. There's going to be a lot of depressed, angry people. And so those of you that have done the heart work, done the heart and soul work to prepare yourself and aren't in grief or confusion yourself are going to be the compassionate guides when lots of people in Port Townsend are needing support, and they're not going to simply find it in other places. So it's not just finding meaning in the dark for ourselves, but how do we help others find meaning in their own lives in these challenging times so that when all of us are on our deathbed, whenever that is, my father is in the hospital. He could die in the next 3 or 4 days. We thought he was getting better yesterday. Today it doesn't seem quite so. And so I'm dealing with this very personally in a family way, but he's at peace with his mortality. But my point is that whenever any of us are on our deathbed, that we can feel that those months and years of challenging times were actually the most meaningful and important times of our lives because we were able to be a blessing to so many others. Amen.